Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with our analysis of the book Legacy of Deception by Stephen Singular that is subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. What it's really about is the framing of O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson was framed with a capital W and a capital F. It remains to be determined precisely whether, in fact, as Singular's source within the L.A. legal system alleges, Mark Furman was involved with this, or whether other elements were involved with framing O.J. Simpson. Certainly more than Furman were involved with this particular framing. However, it is very disturbing to note that O.J. Simpson is viewed by most white people anyway as guilty, and that the media have gone to great lengths to continue to portray him in that fashion. I was extremely skeptical from the beginning that O.J. Simpson could have done what he was alleged to have done simply because it appeared to be physically impossible. One person with an edged weapon killing two people in that fashion, cutting their throats so the carotid artery is cut, and then engaging in a violent struggle in which a snugly fitting glove and a watch cap were supposedly torn from his head. He has no marks on him, hardly any blood. He then had a grand total of 6 minutes with which to dispose of the murder weapon, the bloody clothes, get showered, cleaned up, and downstairs. Good luck. It's just physically impossible. Also, no one heard anything, and it simply was physically impossible, and if O.J. Simpson had been white, he never would have been indicted. It is shameful that the media and the rest of the society continue to portray O.J. Simpson as guilty, whereas he was framed. And he may very well have been framed, in part at least, if not in whole, by Nazi elements within the L.A. legal system. We've already talked about the orientation of Mark Furman, who may very well be a Nazi, and other elements. We're now going to go into the allegations made by Stephen Singular's source inside of the L.A. legal system about how O.J. Simpson was framed. By the way, this book, Legacy of Deception, was copyrighted in 1995 by Dove Books. That's spelled D-O-V-E. The author, Stephen Singular, is described on the back cover. Stephen Singular is a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. And again, we should note that the source who chose Stephen Singular to access the information he had chose him specifically because of his work on the Alan Berg book. And again, that book, Talk to Death. Stephen Singular's source inside of the L.A. legal system maintains that, or alleges that Furman broke a stick off a wooden fence and lifted up the bloody glove, the famous glove that was found on O.J.'s property with, by the way, no blood anywhere near it. There was not a lot of material stuck to it, which one would expect if the glove had been dropped on the ground. Also note the absence of blood on the white carpet in O.J.'s home, the fact that the bloody socks that were found there were clearly not visible in a video that was taken some minutes before that. If O.J. Simpson was white and in a civilized society, or a truly civilized society, he never would have been indicted, let alone subjected to the ordeal that he was subjected to. This is not to sanction domestic violence or to say that, maintain that O.J. Simpson was necessarily an angel. However, there are also many evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of organized crime. O.J. Simpson himself may have been involved with it. People have chosen to ignore that. That is not discussed in the book. Perhaps we'll have time to go into that at the end of the series, but we'll just see how it goes. Of the allegations by Singular source that Furman used a stick to scoop up a bloody glove, put it in a blue plastic LAPD evidence bag, and that evidence bag was later found very near O.J.'s property, Singular writes, quote, because Furman was one of the first detectives at the murder scene, and by the way, this is quoting, the conversation between Stephen Singular and Carl Douglas, one of O.J.'s attorneys. Singular was in close contact with O.J.'s defense, who did not use most of the information that Singular gave them, despite the fact that he obviously was right on the money. We're going to see the questionable conduct of some of O.J.'s attorneys later on in the case. They apparently had settled on the racial card from the beginning. I also wonder about the possibility of a deliberately blown defense on the part of some of O.J.'s attorneys. That is often the case in national security-related cases. And again, it is my suspicion that the O.J. Simpson case was a domestic intelligence operation, what is known as a PSYOP. Again, that is an opinion. I can't prove it. Again, if time allows, perhaps we can go into some of the peripheral intelligence connections to this case. Because Furman, and again, this is the conversation between Singular and Carl Douglas, one of O.J.'s attorneys, and also a Croatian-American veteran of the LAPD named Bill Pavlic, P-A-V-E-L-I-C. Because Furman was one of the first detectives at the murder scene, he had found some of the evidence. He knew where everything was. When he returned to the condo, it was still the middle of the night and completely dark. In his preliminary hearing testimony, he initially said that he saw two gloves. He saw, quote, them, unquote, lying at Goldman's feet. Then he changed his story and said it was only one glove, unquote. We already know that, Douglas said. I've been told that when Furman returned to the condo, he went around to the back of Nicole's property and broke a stick off a wooden fence. A stick? Douglas said. He looked at his investigator. You ever hear anything about a stick? No, Pavlic said. There is no stick. By the way, as we will see, Pavlic is wrong about this. What else? Douglas said to me. I was told that Furman went back around to the front of the condo where the bodies were. Using this long, slender, broken piece of fence, he picked up one of the gloves near Goldman's feet. He put the glove in a small, blue plastic evidence bag which homicide detectives take with them to crime scenes. Then he concealed the bag in his pocket and kept the stick somewhere on his person. You ever hear of a blue bag? Douglas asked Pavlic. No, Pavlic answered, shaking his head. There's no stick, and there's no bag, unquote. As we will see, Pavlic is just flat-out wrong about this. There was both a stick and a bag. Still more about the stick and the bag. Again, this is Singular talking. Yes, I've been told that the stick and the blue bag were recovered, this is Singular once again, repeating his allegations. Yes, I've been told that the stick and the blue bag were recovered from O.J.'s property and are being kept with some other pieces of evidence, unquote. Douglas glanced at Pavlic, who said nothing. Have you looked at all the evidence, I asked them? Not all of it, Douglas said, but there's no stick or bag in what I've seen. There is one other thing, I continued. What's that, the lawyer said. After O.J. returned from Chicago on June 13th, he was taken into custody and blood was drawn from his arm. Correct, Douglas replied sharply. That's the first thing you've said that I know is true. By the way, Singular source here maintains that that blood from O.J. Simpson's blood sample was indeed planted in numerous places, as was alleged by the defense. And again, this book makes a very convincing case, a very convincing case that O.J. Simpson was framed. Continuing. There is one other thing, I continued. What's that? The lawyer said. After O.J. returned from Chicago on June 13th, he was taken into custody and blood was drawn from his arm. Correct, Douglas replied sharply. That's the first thing you've said that I know is true. I've been told that his drawn blood was then stored in a vial that contains a preservative. Pavlic nodded and Douglas repeated, a preservative? Yes, I've been told that some of the blood, which the LAPD says they picked up at the crime scene, will turn out to be O.J.'s blood. It will contain his DNA. We suspect that's right, Douglas said, and I've been told that a test conducted on this blood will prove that it could not have come out of his body on the night of the crime. How could it prove that, Douglas said? Traces of a preservative will show up in all blood that's been stored in this type of vial. I paused and then added, as far as I can tell, that is the only provable thing in this case, unquote. Pavlic made another sarcastic sound. Anything else, Douglas prompted? I was told that after the blood was drawn from O.J.'s arm, someone got hold of the vial, extracted blood from it with a syringe, went back to the crime scene, and perhaps to O.J.'s estate, and sprinkled some of this blood around. I was told that just enough blood was used to make Simpson look guilty, but not enough to make it look as if the blood had obviously been planted. Certain police detectives, I was told, are very clever at doing these kinds of things, and at covering their tracks. And so again, please note, as we will deal with the issue of the planted blood samples and also the preservative that was in that blood apparently later. Note also that Bill Pavlic, the Croatian-American policeman, a former L.A. cop, who was serving as a private investigator for O.J.'s defense team, denied that a stick and a blue bag had been found. As we will see, that was not the case. Still later, Stephen Singular writes, there is a piece of evidence that's made of plastic that was found. Actually, let me begin a little bit earlier here. I'll try to learn something more. There is a piece of evidence that's made of blue plastic that was found at O.J.'s, but I don't think it's the bag you were talking about. It's probably something else, and there is a stick down at the police station. Where did it come from? It was also picked up at O.J.'s house. We have confirmed that. So again, as we are beginning to see, the initial denials about the stick and bag being non-existent are beginning to fall apart. And as we shall see, there was indeed a stick and a bag, and it was a blue LAPD evidence bag, and it was found just on the other side of a fence from where the bloody glove was found. Still later, in discussing the pretrial statement of Mark Furman, the author writes, "The second thing that stood out in Furman's testimony came on page 37. While discussing how Simpson's Ford Bronco was parked in front of his home that morning, the detective said, quote, "The rear end was kicked out a little bit towards the street. The front end was real close to the curb with the tires turned into the curb. It's just, when I was walking towards it, it looked a little strange for the area since there is no parallel parking. As I walked closer, I noticed a piece of wood lying on the parkway, which is very well manicured. It looked like it came from a picket fence. I looked at it closer, and it looked as if it was freshly broken. The wood hadn't been weatherized, the exposed part." The prosecutor who was questioning Furman, Marcia Clark, did not ask him anything about this, quote, "freshly broken," unquote, piece of fence, and it never surfaced again during the hearing. As I studied this part of the testimony, I wondered why he'd mentioned the piece of wood. It appeared to have no relevance to what he was talking about, and it seemed like a meaningless thing to say. Apparently, no one on the defense team had found any significance in these remarks either, because none of them brought it up on cross-examination. This was the stick I'd been told about. And still later, when Stephen Singular himself visited Nicole's condo at South Bundy, where the bodies were found, he found a broken piece of a picket fence there, which may very well have been this stick, although it's unclear whether that was the stick or whether it was just a broken slat from the fence. If so, then somebody had replaced this particular stick. And of his arrival on the crime scene and his own investigation, Stephen Singular writes, "As I stood in the alley facing 875 Bundy, to my immediate right was another residence with a gated and fenced-in storage area. I walked over and gazed at the area, which was crowded with lawn and lawn equipment. The gate is made of wire interwoven with long vertical strips of lathe. I studied the gate and gradually lowered my eyes. About 6 inches from the bottom, the eighth lathe from the right was cracked all the way across its face. I kneeled down and pushed against it. Nothing happened. When I pulled up on the broken section, it gave slightly. I jiggled it, and slowly it came loose. Yanking it free, I held it in front of me, examining the smooth slivers and realizing that it had been cleanly snapped off. I glanced over my shoulder, but no one was watching me. I was excited but deeply skeptical. This didn't look like the piece of wood I'd originally been told about, and as far as I knew, that sliver had already been found and was downtown at the police station. And yet, had this rough fragment of wood played any role in the investigation of this double homicide? Was it one of the missing clues, or just a broken piece of lathe? Again, that is altogether unclear from the context here. What is clear, however, is that eventually the truth did come out, at least to a certain extent, and that indeed there was a stick that had been found, a broken piece of wood, and that indeed there was a blue plastic LAPD evidence bag that had very possibly contained the glove that was found at O.J.'s. And again, there has never been any legal finding in this case. One of the tragic and horrifying aspects of the case is that the very compelling evidence presented by Stephen Singular was never followed up either by the defense or the prosecution. And in describing his being shown a couple of books in containing photographs of some of the pieces of evidence in this case, Singular writes, "I sense the volumes contained pictures of the evidence in the case. These were things Douglas had once told me he would never show to an outsider. He flipped one book open, revealing a photograph of a slender, broken piece of wood. 'Is that the piece of fence I told you about?' I said. 'Yes.' 'That's something I gave you that exists as evidence. Is there a picture of the bag?' He turned to another page, and I saw a photo of a crumpled piece of blue plastic lying on the ground right next door to Simpson's Rockingham address. On one side of a cyclone fence was this plastic object, and on the other side was where the second bloody glove had been found. 'Very good,' I said. 'That's something else I gave you. And indeed, this was something else that Stephen Singular had given the defense. And yet, the defense, for whatever reason, did not use this particular evidence. Still more about the stick and the bag. By now it was nearly 5 p.m. The court session would end soon. Cochran, it seemed to me, had accomplished just about everything with the detective that he was going to, at least for today. I decided to take a walk. As I was putting on my coat in the hallway, I continued listening to the cross-examination. I heard Cochran ask another question, and then I stopped cold. Dropping my coat, I ran back into the living room and stared at the television. Cochran was showing Detective Lang a picture of a small object made, Cochran said, of, quote, blue plastic, unquote. It had been found by the police a few feet away from the bloody glove that had been discovered on Simpson's property, just on the other side of the chain-link cyclone fence that separated his land from his neighbors. When Cochran asked Lang what this object was, the detective appeared not to know. He seemed completely unaware of the existence of such a thing. Cochran brought out another photograph. This one was of a thin and, as he said, splintered, unquote, piece of broken wood found on the parkway at Simpson's residence. Again, Lang said he had no reaction to it. The attorney asked him if the stick had been tested by the police for traces of blood or fingerprints. The detective was unsure how to answer these questions. Cochran showed both photographs to the judge before entering the stick and the bag into evidence. Until this moment, I'd been uncertain if the defense was going to use these items and make them an official part of the trial. Now that they were in front of the jury, I could not keep still, could not stop pointing at the TV screen. Someone gazing through my front window just now would have seen a grown man leaping into the air. And again, that the defense did not, however, make appropriate use of this piece of information. Note that the former L.A. cop, who was the investigator for the defense team, initially denied that both things existed. As we have seen, both things did in fact exist. And also note that the stick came up during the course of Marcia Clark's examination of cross-examination, or her questioning of Mark Furman. However, she never really developed this point very far. And indeed, in light of some of the other things Marcia Clark didn't develop fully, such as looking into the very compelling information that Mark Furman may be of Nazi sympathies, if not an actual Nazi with a capital N, Marcia Clark, informed of the information presented by Detective Purdy, she knew about that and chose to ignore that particular information. The author here is beginning by talking about the sympathy on the part of callers to talk shows for Mark Furman and their outrage that people could have suggested he might have planted evidence or might be a racist. And recall, that was the case initially. Many people had agreed with him. During his testimony, both black and white Americans called TV and radio talk shows and offered Furman their sympathy. They said it was a terrible thing for the defense team to have made these unfounded allegations against the man, charging him with being a racist who may even have planted evidence. This police officer was clearly above reproach, and it was awful to see him smeared by shameless lawyers. Toward the end of Furman's direct exam, Marcia Clark brought out a mysterious object covered with brown paper and placed it in front of the witness. Slowly and dramatically, he unwrapped the paper, revealing the piece of wood that he'd found on the parkway of Simpson's home on the morning of June 13th. He was never asked to explain why he'd mentioned this stick in his preliminary hearing testimony, or how it was relevant to the trial, or where it had come from, or why he'd gone out of his way to bring it up in his earlier courtroom appearance. He never said anything that could have accounted for its presence in these legal proceedings. After Furman displayed the sliver of wood to the jurors, neither he nor Clark nor the defense team pursued the matter further. It was a curious demonstration indeed. I would second that one. Again, nobody brought this up further. And if one assumes that O.J. Simpson was guilty, just what in the world was it doing on O.J.'s property? What would he have been doing with it? Well, again, this book presents compelling information that O.J. Simpson was framed. As we're about to see, in discussing the issue of possibly planting the glove, and in cross-examining Mark Furman, F. Lee Bailey, who handled that part of O.J. Simpson's defense, did not choose to bring up the blue plastic bag that was found on the other side of the cyclone fence from O.J.'s property. He instead used a Ziploc sandwich bag. The stick was not brought up either by the defense or by the prosecution again. And F. Lee Bailey's puzzlingly inept handling of this aspect of the case was one of the things that left most people feeling that the defense was ridiculous, whereas F. Lee Bailey could have gone a long way towards proving that O.J. Simpson was framed. Again, rather than showing the jury this blue bag and then bringing that up in his cross-examination of Mark Furman, Bailey chose to ignore that and to use a Ziploc bag. Stephen Singular discusses F. Lee Bailey's cross-examinations of Furman as follows. On Wednesday, March 15th, while Furman was still testifying, the defense raised the allegation that the detective had not merely planted one of the bloody gloves at Simpson's estate, but also wiped the glove inside the Bronco before dropping it on the ground. Bailey hammered away at Furman's contention that he was not a racist and had not used the term nigger in the past decade to describe African Americans. Under oath, the detective firmly stated that he had not spoken that word during the past 10 years, and anyone who said he had was a liar. Well, that obviously turned out to be less than forthright on Furman's part. Bailey again returned to the notion that the glove found at O.J.'s residence had been placed in the kind of plastic bag that is standard issue in a homicide kit. The lawyer then produced a bag and put a glove inside of it. But for some inexplicable reason, this was not a crinkly blue evidence bag, but a clear, smooth Ziploc bag, the kind one might use to store leftovers in. And the glove Bailey was employing in this demonstration was not an extra-large size like the one recovered from Simpson's home, but a size small. Even stranger still, Bailey suggested that Furman had not concealed the glove and the bag in his pocket, as I'd been told months earlier, and as seemed logical, but had placed these items in his sock. Marines were taught to do things like that, the lawyer said, and Furman was a former Marine. The bag scenario laid out by Bailey was the subject of ridicule throughout the nation. Comedians and commentators milk it for laughs, befuddled by the attorney's performance. Why had he used this bag in the wrong size of glove if he was serious about showing that evidence had been moved and how it had been done? Why would anyone stuff something this cumbersome into his sock? These were legitimate questions. I had other ones. Why hadn't the lawyer asked Furman about the stick? Why hadn't he asked the detective if he'd known Nicole Simpson? Why hadn't he pursued some recent reports suggesting that, years before Nicole's death, Furman had spoken to other police officers and told them her, quote, boob job, unquote, looked good? Wouldn't this line of questioning have raised the possibility that Furman had known the victim personally and had been motivated to plant evidence because of this knowledge? Why didn't Bailey ask whether Furman had moved the glove over to O.J.'s, not because of his worst impulses, but because of his best ones? What if he'd done this not to frame an innocent man, but to catch a vicious killer? Why had the attorney opened the defense up to such ridicule if he didn't intend to go further and give the story more substance and reality? Marcia Clark, who fought bitterly with Bailey during Furman's testimony, called the plastic bag theory a fantasy that had no connection whatsoever to a, quote, search for the truth, unquote. Most people felt the same way she did, and they had no reason to feel otherwise. As the cross-examination of the detective neared its completion, I experienced the sort of frustration I often feel watching murder trials. It seemed to me Bailey was hovering near something important, but then pulled back, unable or unwilling to provide the jury with an alternative scenario for what Furman might have done on the night of the crime. This was disheartening to watch, because with this particular witness, Simpson's lawyers had been given real physical objects to work with, but instead they'd opted to use a Ziploc baggie. And again, I don't recall anything, and Singular does not write anything about Bailey bringing up that photograph that we just saw existed of the crumpled blue bag on the other side of a cyclone fence right near from O.J.'s property, right near where the glove was found. The last thing we're going to look at concerns a curious statement made by Mark Furman at the pretrial hearing, indicating that Mark Furman had quite a considerable awareness of the status of the rocky marriage and dissolving marriage between O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson, and in particular, he knew precisely what the custody status of their children was. Again, with regard to Mark Furman's pretrial statement, Stephen Singular writes, "As I studied the documents Douglas had sent, three things leapt out at me. All were in Furman's testimony. The first was on page 68, where he told the court about something that had passed through his mind in the immediate aftermath of the murders. I would be concerned with the younger Simpson children and the ex-husband, since they, Nicole and O.J., still had joint custody of the children," unquote. How, I asked myself, did he know about this joint custody arrangement? Was it common knowledge at the West Los Angeles Police Department, or had he been told that by Nicole herself? No one on the defense team had asked him these questions. And we are going to continue with our analysis of the O.J. Simpson case. As we're going to see, there certainly was more than just Mark Furman involved in the framing of O.J. Simpson, if in fact Furman was involved, as Singular source within the L.A. legal system has alleged. Indeed, there were a number of people involved in framing O.J. Simpson. A blood of his was planted at the crime scene, and the glove appears to almost certainly to have been planted at O.J.'s house, and it remains to be determined just exactly why the defense did not pursue many of these leads as vigorously as they might have.